I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. I have a question for all you Red Sox fans. Do you remember where you were in 2004? It's Game 6 of the American League Championship, and Curt Schilling just pitched his famous Bloody Sock game against the Yankees. My guest Jason Schwartz does. He also is keenly aware how that euphoric moment compares to watching Curt Schilling striking out big time with his gaming enterprise, 38 Studios. Jason Schwartz is a senior editor of Boston Magazine. In the August issue, he's published his exclusive interview with the baseball giant, Curt Schilling. Jason Schwartz, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
And this is the first time that Curt Schilling has actually spoken very frankly in this piece about how it all happened.
Yeah, you know, we went really in depth. He had done an appearance on WEEI, but didn't really get into a lot of the nuts and bolts of what exactly went wrong. They were more arguing about the politics of the whole thing. It was pretty silly. But yeah, we really get into why the company failed, what went wrong, and just what the troubles were.
I read the piece and I thought, this is overall a story about a guy with a dream, that being Curt Schilling. But then as you go into your very detailed piece, it's the story of video game creation, business acumen or lack thereof, financing and state pride, personal attributes of bravado and confidence, and much, much more. How did you sense all of this as it was coming at you as he was in this in-depth conversation with you?
Well, you know, it's really an impression I got from talking to a lot of his employees. So Curt was actually really the last person I talked to for the story. I talked to a bunch of people who work there, people who really know the video game industry, and tried to get a sense for what exactly happened. And it really came together. It felt sort of like a Greek tragedy, because here was a guy, you know, like you say, he had this big dream, and he was very generous to his staff, and he was just the most optimistic person on earth. But in the end, it was that generosity and the optimism that brought him down.
So let's start sort of at where you start, even though Curt Schilling was the last person that you interviewed. I was surprised, I guess I hadn't paid attention to this, that his actual video game company started in 2006. Mm-hmm. So what we experienced, we the public, at the end when he went into bankruptcy was really many years in the making.
Yeah, you know, the thing that became very clear working on this story is that this company didn't go out of business in May or June. It went out of business in 2006 when he founded it, and just with very unrealistic goals.
Why were the goals unrealistic? What were his goals?
He wanted to build the most complex possible video game. It's called a MMO, a massively multiplayer online role-playing video game. It's a mouthful. But it's even worse to try to build one. It takes at least 4 years for an established company to do that. For a company just getting off the ground, you can imagine it's that much harder. It's the most, I would say, in the entertainment industry, take it all in, it's about the most expensive and complicated thing you can do. You know, short maybe of, you know, a big summer blockbuster movie. But it was a huge challenge for someone who had no experience in video games, and it was just really an ambitious undertaking, to say the least.
So you describe it in your piece as sort of like going from making a small indie film with your two partners and no money to going to making Avatar.
Right, yeah. There's a pretty good analogy between the video game industry and the movie industry, and they were essentially a small startup. They were, you know, that indie movie house coming up with their first movie, and instead of, you know, starting small, figuring out how to do it, learn the ropes with, you know, that indie flick that maybe gets picked up somewhere and gets good word of mouth, they went straight for the summer blockbuster. They tried to do Avatar, you know, Batman, whatever you want, and it backfired. You know, you need a lot of experience to do something that big. It's very, very hard, and even when people who have the experience try it, it doesn't often work.
So just for people who are not familiar with video games in this way, mm-hmm. A multiplayer game, it means that I could log on or enter into it and play with anybody, as many people around the world in my town. Mm-hmm. Anybody could play with me around the world. That's amazing in and of itself. That's different from a single player game where I just sort of turn it on and play with myself or maybe my friend next door.
Right. This is not like Mario Brothers. A good example is the biggest MMO out there is World of Warcraft. It's the industry leader and really very similar to the game Schilling was trying to build. They've got 10 million users who all pay to subscribe and log on at different times. So it's not just you're designing a video game. You're designing basically basically a social space, a place where people interact. One video game executive described it to me as much anthropology as, you know, technology. So it's just could not be a more complicated undertaking.
So the reason I raise that so people understand that is because this was his dream. This and only this was what he wanted to make happen in the video game. That's what he hired all the people for. That's all the expertise was going toward, was to make that kind of product.
Right. And here's sort of another element of the Greek tragedy is that Kurt Schilling, I think, is very well known as a very charitable guy. Everyone knows he wrote KALS for Lou Gehrig syndrome on his cleats, involved in tons of great charitable causes. So for him, at least the way he told it to me, what he saw this is as his one chance to get mega rich, Bill Gates rich. He had, you know, a pretty good pot of money from playing baseball. He wanted a huge pot of money so he can make a huge difference. And he looked at the video game industry and he said, I love video games. I want to build a video game. If I'm going to become mega rich, it's got to be an MMO. It's got to be one of these massive things. Now, you might argue in retrospect that maybe he should have been a little more patient or had, you know, goals that were a bit more realistic. But that's what he was thinking at the time.
Okay, so this is a guy who has no video game experience, but here was really the killer, as you outlined it in his piece. He had no business experience in this way. So he went from being on the mound, was certainly with a brand of determination that we know about, hanging in there with a bloody sock to play a game, now to build a business. And these days we talk about portfolio skills, you know, what you take with you can translate across various venues, but in this case, not so much.
Yeah, and you know, to clarify, he had video game experience in the sense that he played a lot of video games.
Well, then I haven't. Yeah. If that's the case, Jason, come on.
We can go all start all sorts of businesses.
Yeah.
No, he never on the business side. And, you know, even more than that, it's I think a thing that can't be underestimated here is he'd never worked in an office before. It's the silliest thing, but, you know, his whole life was, you know, in the clubhouse, in the baseball stadium. It's a different set of rules, different ways of interacting. So much to the point that when he started 38 Studios, someone had to sit down and explain to him how vacations and weekends work. He had even suggested a system where people work 15 straight days or something like that and take 5 days off, or I think it was 14 days and take five off, which is crazy. That doesn't work in the real world. He had taken it from his baseball experience. Now that's not a thing that sunk the company, but sort of shows you the place he was coming from.
But it was a microcosm of what was happening every day in other parts of the company. Hiring relatives, some were equipped to do the jobs they were doing, but you know, we know who work in other businesses what happens when you have nepotism strewn across the company.
Well,
that's not good.
Really, the big thing is, yeah, and he just never understood the dynamics of how an office works. So really, the biggest problem he had in that sense was he never clearly defined his role in the company. He was the founder and chairman. But, you know, he just sort of did whatever he wanted on a day-to-day basis as the guy with the money, the guy in charge. Which made, you know, life difficult for his executives, sort of made it unclear what everyone else's jobs were. So as a result of that, you had a lot of people working at cross purposes, not really knowing what to do, fighting for turf. And as you can imagine, that did not lead to a productive and happy company.
And what you expressed in the piece was that he kept pushing forward, thinking that if I just bring the kind of drive and determination that I have to this and imbue that with everybody here in the office, somehow we get to the next level. I thought this quote was very telling in the piece. He says, I had to beat the Yankees 3 times in 9 days. I never doubted I was going to do it. My whole life was spent doing things that people didn't believe were possible because God blessed me with the ability to throw a baseball. And I carried that same mentality into everything I did here.
Yeah, and you know, the fascinating thing about that quote is he recognizes how blessed he was to have that golden right arm, but also doesn't recognize that maybe, you know, the blessedness stops at the end of the arm. Just because you're good at baseball, it doesn't mean you're good at other things. You know, just because, you know, we're good at other things doesn't mean we're good at baseball. But he was convinced because he'd had success in baseball, as much as you can have, he knew how to have success, and he thought that would carry over.
So one of the things that also continued to undermine him was that, and you've said, you know, he was generous with his employees. But again, back to he was operating kind of a Google at this point, a current Google, the kind of amenities that Google might offer. But he was a startup. And he was offering those kind of amenities. Just to mention a few, they had goodies like free gym memberships, two homes that the companies rented to temporarily house new out-of-state hires, 1 year at Christmas, new laptop computers for every employee. A lot of these gifts came out of his own pocket, but it was so much in terms of travel and entertainment that according to what one case study by Harvard pulled together, they were spending something like $700,000 a year.
Yeah, it was worked out to about $5,000 or $8,000, depending on the year, five or $8,000 per person, which is sort of crazy if you think about it. You know, the money lost on that stuff, a lot of it came out of Kurt's pocket with the gifts. I mean, certainly they were spending a lot on benefits and others, sort of making the office a comfortable place to work. I think as big an issue as that, though, is the culture it created. Because like you say, it felt like Google. I talked to a lot of employees who worked there, and everyone said, you know, this was a comfortable place to work. It didn't feel like – this was not like a ramen noodle startup, which is really what it should have been, given that there was no hope of revenue for at least 4 years from the start, and that was ambitious. I mean, realistically, they were talking about no revenue for 5 or 6 years, and then they were, you know – it felt like an established company, and that really sent the wrong message, I think, to a lot of people there.
Now, maybe it would have been a bad situation if it was all his money, but it wasn't. So we're talking about investors who put money in, and more importantly, he left Massachusetts from that 2006 startup in Maynard and moved to Rhode Island because he was got a guaranteed loan from Rhode Island to shore up the company. And that's where it got really sticky.
Right. And actually, to clarify, the big issue for him was that he never got outside investors. They had one company come in to publish a video game. They had produced a console game out of a studio they actually bought in Baltimore. But writ large, he was never able to attract investors to the company, which should have been a very bad sign to Rhode Island that after, you know, literally for the first 3 to 4 years of the company's existence, they were having meetings every week with investors. And every single one of them passed. And then came Rhode Island and said, here's $75 million. We don't even want equity. We don't want a seat on the board. Just make sure, you know, we'll set some conditions so you have to hire a lot of people, but, you know, go have fun. And that was a very, very bad idea.
And we should circle back and say that a lot of those investors did pass because of some of the perks that they thought were outrageous at this time. The way that the structure or the infrastructure had been set up in the company, all of that led investors to say, I don't see how my money's coming back to me when you're doing it this way.
Yeah. You know, I talked to one of the guys who went in there for a meeting, a venture capitalist from Spark Capital, one of the best venture capital firms around. And he said, you know, things that concerned him were, first, he recognized that there was no real experience with developing a video game this complicated at the top of the company, which is a big red flag. But there were two other big issues. One is that they just seemed overconfident. They didn't quite understand what the challenge they were facing was. But also, Kurt held on very tight to equity in the company. When it ended, he still owned 82.9% of the company, which, you know, that's now he owns 82.9% of nothing. But all along, he was very hesitant to give any of that up because he was, you know, funding the thing himself, which is a big problem if you're trying to get investors because then, you know, what do you have to do a deal with?
Right. You have nothing.
Yeah.
And they're not interested. So here's the timeline that many of us knew about. In May 1st, the 38 Studios makes no loan payment back to Rhode Island. May 15th, they missed the payroll. May 24th, the staff found out via email that they were laid off. And June 7th, they filed for bankruptcy. Now, in between that, you have some chilling stories, I would say, for employees who just were all of a sudden abruptly informed that they had no health insurance and no job. And, you know, one of the stories about the gentleman with a wife who really needed her health insurance in the moment was really quite touching.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of those types of stories. You know, there was one of the vice presidents at the company. His wife needed a bone marrow transplant at the moment their health insurance disappeared. Another employee, his wife literally found out from their doctor that their health care payments were being cut off. And there's also the issue with MoveTrek, which is a company. When they were moving from Massachusetts to Providence, they hired to basically buy employees' homes and resell them to make it easier for them to move. MoveTrek had not managed to sell all those employees' homes yet, so the mortgages, it looks like, may very well revert back to the original, you know, the employees who thought they, you know, they'd sold their house. So now you have people stuck with, you know, mortgages in Massachusetts, rent or mortgage in Rhode Island. not having a job, not having health care, and they just could not be in a worse situation. And it's just been a torturous couple months for a lot of those, you know, 400 employees.
Now, what I think is interesting in the piece is that toward the end, you say that lots of people still think highly of him, and they had nice things to say. A couple of people, not so much. So here's the vice president of online services. His quote is, "Are you going to admit that your stupid hubris, pride, and arrogance will not allow you to accept that we failed and help shut it down with dignity?" The way in which the company was shut down also came under fire.
Yeah. And, you know, you can argue that every mistake up until that point was just bad decision making. Fine. You made bad decisions. You know, you should have been doing that great. At that point, it becomes something else because they did something really bad to their employees. They never warned them. They never told them. They were still hiring all the way into March. They hired two new executives in March when they had already stopped paying a lot of their bills. So it's really galling to a lot of people. I talked to a lot of local video game executives who were just extremely upset at how this went down, thought it reflected very poorly on everyone. But Kurt had even, by his own admission, told people that if money was going to run out, he'd give 60 days notice. You know, keep people in the loop so they can plan, so they can unwind the company in a responsible way, pay off creditors, severance, you know. That never happened. And he really hasn't had a satisfying explanation of why that is. And I'm not even sure he knows anymore. I think things got spinning very fast for him. But it was very, very poorly done.
It must be noted that Kurt Schilling, prior to his seeking out the kind of loan guarantee that he got from Rhode Island, was not a person in favor of big government, and that would be considered big government. He was small government, do it on your own. Maybe that explains why he's holding all that equity himself. So this is like sort of irony all over the place that here he is in a big mess based on something that he's for years said he fundamentally did not agree with.
Yeah, you know, it's easy grist for the mill, I think. You know, he's a small, you know, he campaigns, you know, with a lot of Republican candidates, very small government guy. I don't think you'll see him on the campaign trail this year. But yeah, that's an easy thing to point out, I definitely think. And actually, I think it frustrated a lot of people who worked at the company in the immediate aftermath of all this happening. That's what everyone was focused on, when really there's a much deeper story here.
So what happens now? I mean, where are we now? Because I know there's some lawsuits flying around. Mm-hmm. I can't sort them all out.
Well, the Citizens Bank has sued Kurt Schilling for $2.4 million. He personally guaranteed a loan. He says, he told me that he doesn't have cash. He would have paid. Overall, they stopped paying their employees on May 1st. They fired or laid them off on May 24th. They're owed a collective $1.5 million. Kurt told me that if he had the money, he would have paid them. So you can take him at his word on that or not. That doesn't bode well for that lawsuit. So he could be in trouble with that. There is precedent under federal labor law that he could be personally held accountable for those lost wages plus damages, which would be double. That would have to be the Department of Labor bringing a grievance. And on top of all that, the company is going through Chapter 7 bankruptcy liquidation right now. So there's going to be news on this for quite some time to come.
And Rhode Island, where I mean, we you know, there was a little sniping from, you know, Governor Lincoln Chafee, which Kurt Schilling took exception to. But you can understand that Governor Lincoln Chafee feels a little bit, you know, put out by this, to say the least.
Yeah, no, I mean, Kurt put a lot of the blame for what happened on Governor Lincoln Chafee. I'm not sure that that's fair. What I would say is that Rhode Island deserves 100% of the blame in the first place for actually doing the loan when they never should have agreed to give over that money. That was the original, you know, dumb thing.
So Governor Deval Patrick looks pretty smart for passing.
Governor Patrick looks smart for passing, absolutely. And the oversight of the company, there are a lot of questions to be asked about that because there was supposed to be some state oversight and it was not there apparently. Either that or they were doing a very bad job.
And we should note that Rhode Island is right now one of the most cash-strapped states in the nation.
Unemployment there is among the worst in the country.
Yeah.
But in terms of those end days, I think the scapegoating on Lincoln Chafee is unfair. One person passed along to me, a video game executive, said the governor might have spit on their grave, but that's not murder. So.
All right, so your piece goes from some people accusing him quite harshly of hubris, others, even those who have been, it's fair to say, shafted, still feeling some respect for him, and toward the end, he's taking responsibility as he can, and kind of tearful about what's happened.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you, I talked to him for a couple of hours, and it was a difficult conversation. He was very emotional. Clearly, you know, he's feeling a lot of pain over this. I don't think there's any debating about that. But yeah, he got emotional a few times because I think he recognizes, as much as he'd like to blame the governor for a lot of things, that most of it's his fault. And that's a tough thing, I think, for him to live with, because he really put a lot of stock in feeling like he was treating his employees well. That was a very important thing to him, and he'll go on and on about that. So for him to, at the end, do the most terrible, really, thing he could have to them is, you know, that's really something.
Well, Jason Schwartz, thank you so much for debriefing us on this, really, and I use the word eye-opening deliberately. It was pretty eye-opening. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been talking about Kurt Schilling and how his gaming enterprise, 38 Studios, went so wrong. I've been speaking with Jason Schwartz, senior editor of Boston Magazine. His exclusive interview with Kurt Schilling is in the August issue. You can find a link to it on our website. Kara Miller is here in Studio 3.
Hi, Kelly. So have you ever been in a situation where you can't find your glasses, you can't find your keys, and you're looking everywhere, and it turns out they've just been sitting there in plain sight right in front of you?
Oh, yep, this morning.
So that is what we're talking about today. I'm going to speak to one of the authors of The Invisible Gorilla, which looks at all the ways that our brains trick us, from what we think we see to how we think about ourselves.
And what does the gorilla have to do with this?
And that's what we're going to find out. I'm Kara Miller.
And I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.